The Hoop Heads Podcast is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
One life-changing thing that I've incorporated into my daily activity, as I share with the group, is what I call the 10-minute miracle. I often say we are a slave to the first thing we do in the morning. And unfortunately, in many cases, the first thing that we deal with may be something that's a subconscious response, meaning it's our phone. We have our phone laying right by our head, close to our bed, within arm's reach. So probably throughout the night, we've been looking and glancing, so we're impacting our sleep, which is another discussion within itself. But secondly, before we can start our day, we've already programmed ourselves with information that we may not necessarily have wanted. So we have to deal with all these other things, from the emails that came over, from what we may have seen on the news, some personal things that may be happening, as opposed to what I do, and I've been doing for several years now, is I sleep with my phone in my office. It's away from me. My wife and daughter are safe because they're within the earshot of me. But I make sure I download what I want first into my life in the morning. For those first 4 minutes being writing down what I'm grateful for, the next 4 minutes writing down attributions, things I want to happen as if they're happening already, and using the remaining 2 minutes to meditate. So what I do every day for the first 10 minutes, I cleanse. And I allow myself to download the information that is beneficial to me and my goals. So I get a constant download of the personal and professional goals that I want to achieve.
Lindsay Huddleston is the founder of Sports Psychology Solutions. He holds a bachelor's degree in political science and a master's degree in psychology with specialization in sports psychology. Lindsay is a member of the Association for Applied Sports Psychology. Mr. Huddleston has been an athlete and coach at his alma mater, Detroit Henry Ford High School. Currently, he travels the state of Michigan in the United States, presenting to athletes and non-athletes about mental toughness and social media etiquette. He is also a USA Basketball Youth Development Academy national speaker. Lindsay has been an author, educator, political appointee of Governor Jennifer Granholm, as well as a corporate and educational lobbyist. Lindsay currently resides in Lansing, Michigan with his wife and daughter. I had the opportunity to hear Lindsay speak at the recent USA Basketball Coaches Academy here in Cleveland, and I believe his message is one that coaches, parents, and players can implement to become more mindful and improve their mental toughness while gaining more control over their life. Get ready to learn from this episode with Sports Psychology Solutions, Lindsay Huddleston.
Hello, and welcome to the Hoop Heads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel, and today we have a very special guest on the podcast, Lindsay Huddleston from Sports Psych Solutions in Detroit, Michigan. I was lucky enough to meet Lindsay at the USA Basketball Coaches Academy in Cleveland that happened a couple weeks ago. Heard him speak to a outstanding group of coaches and just was intrigued by some of the things that he had to share with the audience there. So, Lindsay, welcome to the podcast. Looking forward to the conversation.
Oh, thank you for having me, Mike. Thanks for approaching me afterwards to get involved. I was excited about the opportunity. You didn't have to threaten me to be on your podcast. All you had to do was ask, but the threat worked too. So, no, I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. We appreciate you coming on and jumping in with us. So let's start out here and talk a little bit about your company, Sports Psych Solutions, and tell us how you formed it, why you formed it, what the mission is, and what you're hoping to accomplish with young athletes and the people that you come in contact with.
Oh, great. Well, thank you both. Sports Psych Solutions was created a few years ago out of the need to be able to serve not just athletes in general, but specifically vulnerable populations. After having a career in politics, education, as well as corporate America, I quickly learned about what are sustainable business models. And the challenge you have in sports psychology is, one, overcoming the stigma of some people responding to any type of mental toughness discussion, and two, making a viable business plan. So my thought was, the people who really need me can't afford me, and that's just me speaking from a fair market value standpoint. So I created a nonprofit because I had a strong nonprofit background to be able to allow me to be able to address as many young athletes and coaches as possible with a business model that's sustainable. Because if it's, you know, not the actual athlete himself who can afford my fees, there's another trade-off, if you will, through grants and other type of resources that allow me to kind of go out there and it make sure that my wife doesn't bust me upside the head for just giving time away. You know, but that's pretty much the core of it and what I've been doing, and we've been getting a great response. I've been fortunate To be a part of the USA basketball family for several years, and being able to go and share this message to coaches and players alike. But the core is being able to present the next generation with solutions that can help them with the mental toughness issues that they face, whether it's on the court, on the field, or in life in general.
So talk to us a little bit about how, I know you told the story there at USA Basketball, how you got involved with USA Basketball and how that brought you into the opportunities that you've had to go out and speak and be a part of those coaches' academies.
Sure. I appreciate that. It definitely was a personal moment that brought me there. Like you guys can probably agree, going back to our childhood, that USA Basketball Shield has probably been one of the most prominent images in our life, whether it's the NBA logo with Jerry West or the NFL shield. USA Basketball always represented the best and the elite, if you will. And it was through some soul searching I was experiencing a few years ago when I just really closed my eyes and I said, you know, what is it that I really want? And along with peace on earth came that USA Basketball shield. And I had to recognize that as a sign. And as a side note, I say that to the viewers who are listening. You know, you have to be able to recognize signs in your life. Sometimes when we look for opportunities, it's not really the sky opening up and, you know, a message on a blimp, but it just could be a visual. And that USA Basketball shield said something to me and spoke to my heart. So right then, with that great researcher we have in our pocket called Google, I just Googled USA Basketball, and up popped the first annual USA Basketball Coaches Academy, which you partook in Cleveland, but this was the first one a few years ago in Las Vegas. So now I'm adding things up, as I told you guys when I spoke with the group. You know, USA Basketball, Las Vegas, you can't lose, right? So I jumped on the plane, and the interesting thing about that is I had to make a decision, because at the time, unbeknownst to me, I was about to transition from my corporate lobbying role, and I was faced with the dilemma of deciding which day I wanted to submit to my team that we can meet in a neutral place. In this case, it was going to be Atlanta, Georgia. So I had to have enough gumption to say, you know what, I got to make this trip that weekend. Let me just step out on a limb and give a date that connects with what I'm trying to do. And the only reason I bring that up, Mike and Jason, is because many times we have opportunities, but we're scared to take that next step. So I started that process, and I flew into Atlanta on a Wednesday, and by Friday I was flying to Las Vegas to start this opportunity. And what your viewers and listeners can't see is the image that I shared with you in Cleveland, which was a cool picture of me sitting in the audience, just like you were, Mike. Yeah. Paying attention, listening to a great presentation. And shortly thereafter, I was part of the USA Basketball family. I think the team at USA Basketball Youth like to tell that story, but it's a real story. But I was going through that metamorphosis. I knew I didn't want to coach anymore, and I was interested in sports psychology, but I was happy to be in a place of like-minded people, all energized, all committed to bettering themselves and bettering the young people around them. And that just started the process. And good old Coach Don Showalter, who's great person to many, mentor to many others as well. I sent him the video of me speaking in Detroit at an event, and I was talking about things like flow and optimal performance, and he said, hey, we want to get you booked. So from there, I went to, I believe, New York, to Chicago a few times, been to Cleveland and back again when we got to meet. So all that being said is that it started out with me having a vision, but more importantly, having the courage to step out and take steps. And I say this, you know, kind of going off script a little bit to those who may be listening, is that many times we have our heart desires, but we're so fearful of what other people are going to say. And you have to think about it. The bigger the dream, the crazier the dream, the more people are going to disagree with you trying to attempt it. The more people are going to try to give you an explanation of why that doesn't work. And many times it's only them showing their fear, as opposed to saying why you really can't do it. So to say all that in a nutshell, I had a vision and I took an opportunity and I invested in myself, because the other part of it is these opportunities are not free. As we guys talked offline, we all are parents and have families, and this causes us to redirect resources from our household. But I think it's really important that you look at investing in yourself and betting on yourself, even if it's for exploration to see the next thing. And I'm so glad I did that, because not only has that given me a great chance to work with USA Basketball, it helps me connect with great guys like you, hoop heads, Mike and Jason, and gets me on the show to share a positive message that I hope can impact others.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of looking at it. What I hear you saying is the fact that you're self-aware of what you were kind of doing as you were stepping into that particular opportunity. And I know a lot of times that when people have those situations, they're faced with those dilemmas of, do I take this big step? Do I take this quote-unquote risk? And a lot of people kind of talk themselves out of it because they're really not aware of what they're trying to get out of it. And I think that's a credit to you that you were able to see and have that vision going forward of what you wanted to do. And now, again, I know you're a guy from just the short time that we've known each other that likes to make an impact with people. And by connecting yourself to USA Basketball, you've obviously been able to reach a probably wider audience than you may have been able to do without that platform. So I think that's tremendous. Let's talk a little bit about the mental toughness aspect of what you do. And I know you had a tour through Michigan where you talked about mental toughness and you talked about social media etiquette. And so give us a little bit of your thoughts on mental toughness. First of all, maybe your definition of what it is, and then how kids maybe can improve and how we can look to improve our mental toughness.
Very good. No, I appreciate that. And that's an excellent question about my definition of mental toughness. As much as I talk about it, you know, you probably can come up with so many definitions, but the one thing that comes to mind, the one thing that I think of, is your ability to bounce back. That's your mental toughness. What happens a lot of times, particularly with some of the athletes that I work with, is that they haven't been able to develop enough mental stamina. Now, I'm not trying to introduce a new term as I define one, but I think if you look at it from a standpoint of stamina, you know, how do you increase your stamina from 1 to 10? And a lot of us are in the lower levels and we want to increase that, but that comes with doing a lot of different things, like being able to stay uncomfortable. You know, in many cases, when you look at youth sports, for example, if a team goes down, you know, 3 touchdowns in football, you know, 20 plus points in basketball, you know, a lot of them just want to shut it down because they'll find more comfort in accepting the imminent loss. And I'll repeat that. They'll find more comfort in accepting the imminent loss as opposed to being uncomfortable and fighting for the win. I'll repeat that part again. They'd rather accept the oncoming loss as opposed to being uncomfortable and fighting for the win. And I think that clarifies mental toughness. Can you stand in the moment? Can you dare be in the level or in a situation where you're not necessarily comfortable, but you're willing to fight to get to a point where you can find success? Just to add on that a little bit too, yes, I had the Michigan tour. I went from the Detroit River in Detroit all the way to the Upper Peninsula, almost to the other side of UP Canada, and that was all sparked by a vision too. And along the way, I met young people from all backgrounds, from all different parts of the state. But there's a common theme that we have, is that this generation, whether we call them the social media generation or whatever reference we make, because they can take a selfie 10 times to get the perfect picture, they don't have a lot of experience in being uncomfortable, because there's always an opportunity to fix it instantly. I mean, guys, you remember, we used to take pictures with a photo, I mean, take with a camera.
Disposable camera.
Yeah, we had to wait 10 days for the photos to come back, and I hope you didn't blink because you blew it, you know? So compared to this generation, and as I told you guys, and I'm not knocking these guys, I'm just doing some, you know, observations. They're not used to having to be uncomfortable. So it's about putting them in situations that they can learn that, you know, hey, by being uncomfortable, I can eventually get the result I want, as opposed to not pushing towards that. So I know you started with the question about what I define as mental toughness, but I just can't help but to go a little deeper to talk about, you know, this generation compared to maybe our generation, and there may just be different experiences that lead to the same outcome of mental toughness. So I hope that helps in clarifying that.
I totally agree. I'm a teacher myself. I teach fourth graders, and you're saying about they're not able to accept the uncomfortability. It happens all the time in the classroom, and it happens. And I coach middle school basketball as well. It happens on the court. You know, we've talked several times about how a simple thing like, making the kids try to use their left hand and a left hand layup, they automatically default back to the right hand because they feel so comfortable with it and they're not willing to put themselves out there and try it. I mean, that's a small example of, I know what you're talking about, but I think it's a perfect kind of parallel to basketball and what you just spoke to on mental toughness.
Jason, if I could just add on that, it's funny you say the word default, and I'm looking at my notes from earlier what we were talking. I wrote that word down, default. And I was told, and I'm a believer, that going back since prehistoric time, man has always defaulted to the negative. And we had to do that based on survival, Jason. You know, if you believe that there were, you know, dinosaurs walking the earth at one period, if you were the caveman, you had to look out for that big dinosaur that was coming to eat you. Then we fast forward to, you know, the Wild Wild West, and you would go out on the prairie, and you would go out 30 or 40 or 50 miles from the ranch trying to herd up the cattle, but you had to watch the sky because a tornado at that time could be devastating. So we always default to the negative. And I think what we have to look at today for this generation, even as us as adults, is that there's effort that needs to be made to switch from the negative default to a positive outlook. It's almost like when you get up in the morning and you're laying in the bed, and if you don't have that exciting thing to jump up and do, like record a great podcast like you guys have been doing all this week, or just something that just give you a mission, you're going to lay there until you flip that switch and say, okay, I'm ready. And you got to remember, guys, now we may jump out of bed now, but there had to be one day while we were living on this planet where we didn't want to move, but we had to physically flip that switch, almost like that Iron Man at the carnival where you can hit the bell, you know, based on the big hammer coming down. You have to physically flip that switch. So to your point, Jason, there is a default mechanism that stays on negative. And unfortunately, with social media, with all the negative images young people see, it's so easy for them to stay in the negative and not pursue something instead of being proactive and turning on that positive switch.
So how do you get kids to get out of that comfort zone? How do you drag them out of that feeling that they want to be comfortable all the time? How do you make them, for lack of a better way of saying it, how do you make them comfortable being uncomfortable?
Very good. That's an excellent question, Mike. And we talked about this in Cleveland. One life-changing thing that I've incorporated into my daily activity as I share with the group is what I call the 10-minute miracle. I often say we are a slave to the first thing we do in the morning. And unfortunately, in many cases, the first thing that we deal with may be something that's a subconscious response, meaning it's our phone. We have our phone laying right by our head, close to our bed, within arm's reach. So probably throughout the night, we've been looking and glancing, so we're impacting our sleep, which is another discussion within itself. But secondly, before we can start our day, we've already programmed ourselves with information that we may not necessarily have wanted. So we have to deal with all these other things, from the emails that came over, from what we may have seen on the news, some personal things that may be happening, as opposed to what I do, and I've been doing for several years now, is I sleep with my phone in my office. It's away from me. My wife and daughter are safe because they're within the earshot of me. But I make sure I download what I want first into my life in the morning. For those first 4 minutes being writing down what I'm grateful for, the next 4 minutes writing down attributions, things I want to happen as if they're happening already, and using the remaining 2 minutes to meditate. So what I do every day for the first 10 minutes, I cleanse. And I allow myself to download the information that is beneficial to me and my goals. So I get a constant download of the personal and professional goals that I want to achieve, which keep me on a path, as opposed to fighting through all the junk that you may receive and not know what it's going to do for you. So you never really get a fighting chance. So to go back to your specific question, Mike, about how do you help a young person? Well, first of all, if I have a client who's committed to moving forward, this is one of the first things I make them institute in their life, because I have to have a break in the cycle that they're normally used to. And you won't get that break if they continue to do the same thing when they wake up the first thing in the morning. Now, in many cases, by the time an athlete has come to me or someone has brought them to me, they're ready to make a change because something is not happening right. So they're ready to make that commitment. They're ready to evaluate their relationship with their phone and social media and be open to some constant changes. I'm not saying get rid of it altogether, but they're ready to evaluate that. So once we have them at that point, Mike, then it's much easier to get them to give themselves that break, realize it's a minimum type of trade-off when you talk about the first 10 or 15 minutes of your day compared to having all this use. And the final thing I'll say on that, once they cleanse themselves that first 10 or 15 minutes or so, they have a clean palate. It's almost like when you start on that diet, or you start eating what you're supposed to eat, start working out like you want to. But once you start, you're going to go out of your way not to mess that up. You're going to do everything you can to push away from the table when it's time. You're going to do everything you can to pass because you've committed and you felt this good feeling. So, Mike, I hope that helps as far as a good definition and explanation on how one can go about putting themselves in a position to be comfortable with being uncomfortable, because now they're investing in themselves as opposed to what any and everyone else throws at them.
So here's something that, just to follow up on that, how, when you work with a kid or you work with, you know, let's say a professional player, and you're instituting the 10-minute miracle morning, when you do that, how long does it take before the person becomes, before it becomes habit, before they really get to the point? Because I can see where at first somebody's going to be like, I don't know, I got my, you know, I'm used to checking my phone, I'm used to doing these things, and boy, Lindsay's trying to get me to do something new. How long do you find it takes your clients to get to where it's, man, boom, it's habit, and they're seeing the value in their own mind, in your experience?
Excellent question, Mike. Excellent question. Well, one can first say that it takes 21 to 30 days to change habits. That's one thing. However, I read something a while ago and I thought it was spot on, and this really speaks to my growth in my profession and where I'm at, and you guys can probably relate to that when you talk about growth. You know, there was a consultant who would help people, I believe, with breaking the habit of smoking cigarettes. So in his first consultation with them, he would ask, on a scale of 1 to 10, how bad do you want to stop? And if a person's response, Mike, was a 3 or 4, he'll say, call me back when you're at an 8 or 9. So my point being is, I'm in the business of helping people who want to help themselves. If you're at a point where I have to convince you to try this, we're not really in a good working space right now, because I don't believe I have to try to force you to do something to get better. You should be at a point that what you want to achieve is worth making some sacrifices. And what I find at this point, when I have athletes who are vying for D1 opportunities, when I have athletes like a young man who just texted me who's getting ready to go have a workout with a G League team, when I have athletes who are, you know, returning to, you know, have a great season, they realize much more is at stake, and they're willing to start off with any type of sacrifice. So that's an excellent question, and it really speaks to my evolution in this field, as opposed to me saying, hey, come one, come all, please listen to what I have to say, as opposed to saying, if you're not really willing to listen to what I have for you, then it's not going to work. I even speak of a young man who I was working with and had his full support from his family, and I suggested the 10-minute miracle. He looked at me with a straight face, Mike. He said, I'm just going to tell you right now, I'm not going to do that. said, you know, I guess there's some appreciation for honesty, but the other part is, I said, well, I just want to tell you, man, if you're not willing to make this kind of sacrifice, getting up 10 minutes earlier and doing something like this, I don't know how you're going to move forward. And it's a sad commentary, but to your point, if the person is not really ready, if they're not at an 8 or a 9 as far as how bad they want to do it, then it devalues what I think I can do to help them, so I don't try. But fortunately, I'm at a point that people, this is a slow game. And what do I mean? You got to play the long ball, I should say, when you're in sports psychology. And anyone who's in the field would definitely agree. Many of my colleagues I talk with on a regular basis, we all say the same thing. It may take you a few years to bring in a client, meaning if it's a parent, they've been watching you, they've been thinking about it, but in most cases something happened or something may have happened again, and now they're at the point that they keep seeing you out here making these great things on these great Hoophead podcasts and being known all throughout the region, and they're realizing that they're still doing the same thing that they need to be doing to move forward, I should say. They're still making the same mistakes. So that helps you kind of come together where you as a sports psychologist, your name is out there, you're doing great things, getting great reviews, and this person's saying, we still can't get over that hump. So it has to be a totally engaged body, both the client and the sports psychologist, to really get the best result, if that helps you.
That absolutely helps. I think you made an outstanding point that's applicable in not just the sports psychology realm, but we had sort of a similar discussion last night with Coach Greg White from Arkansas talking about kids that work with, you know, different trainers or coaches, and they come in and, you know, they don't want to work, and they come in and, you know, Coach said, well, why are you here then? You know, I'm not gonna beg you to come and work out and try to get better. If you don't want to get better, then, you know, you're not the right client for me, because I want to work with people who want to get better. And I hear you saying the same thing. And I think that that's, if nothing else, anybody out there who's listening can take that as a lesson, that if you're not willing to take steps and be open to suggestions that can help you, then you're going to have a hard time, as you said, moving forward in whatever it is that you're trying to do, whether it's trying to improve your mind or trying to improve your basketball skills or take it to any other area as well. If you're not willing to be open to somebody who's had experience, who has good ideas, who's willing to help you, then you're probably not going to move forward no matter what the suggestions are.
You're right. And just to follow back up on that, and this is just for you guys as well, Jason and Mike, you know, it's all about the level of value you have for yourself, your craft, and your brand. Now, when the idea of Hoopheads came along and the podcast and all that, you probably would, you know, get whoever was willing to say a word. But as you grow and you grow value, this is not arrogance, this is not anything like that, but when you grow a particular value and expectation for what you've created, you will say, well, you know what, maybe it's not going to work. And I think it really takes you to get to a great place where you can say, regardless of the money, regardless of the accolades, if you're not buying in, as I tell coaches, you can peace out. And there's no love loss, it's nothing, it's a non-issue, but if you're not willing to meet me where I am for what I want to be able to provide to you and for what I believe in to be something that could be helpful, then this just may not be a good fit. And I think too many times we try to force it, or we devalue our own selves and our own brand by trying to get someone to understand. But you have to understand, you have to be at a point where feeling so good about your work, no matter what it is that you're doing, that the person isn't ready to buy in, you need to move on.
Totally agree. I couldn't agree more with that particular statement. Mental toughness, let's jump back to that for a second. And
sure.
Talk about a player that you've worked with or a player that you've observed that you feel has tremendous mental toughness, and what are the characteristics of that particular player that you've observed that you feel make them mentally tough?
It's a very good question. I'll talk about a player that we all know, Miles Bridges. And this is not speaking out of school. I think it was very obvious Miles had a lot of pressure on him when he returned for his second year at Michigan State basketball. And what we didn't talk about is that I spent some time in the Michigan State camp. And disclaimer, this is all pre-allegations and whatnot. But, you know, from summer, from like August to like January. But anyway, you know, Miles had a great amount of pressure on him, and I think people don't really realize that, and we were so quick to scrutinize and point fingers and put holes in this game. But how many times do you have a player that literally has their entire city on their back? I'm not just talking about the physical tattoo he had that said Flint on his back, but when everyone in your city is saying, you have to do this for us. And true indeed, we have young people who go pro and they have, you know, their community behind them. But this man has a city on his back that is now an international icon for strife and challenges. So I think he's a perfect example of someone who was very mentally tough, but had to overcome a lot of challenges as it related to the pressure that was placed upon him. I mean, even the whole idea to return. How many kids do you hear return? And he was returning in a selfless manner. He was not returning to increase his draft stock. He was returning to be able to bring a championship to a team. So that talked about his commitment. And, you know, and one thing Miles would do a lot and people didn't understand is that if he would smile, in many cases that smile was to help break the pressure. But that can be perceived of not being tough or being soft. But my point being is, in many cases with these elite athletes on every level, and we've talked in Cleveland about, I've had general managers talk to me about how you can help their athletes without them thinking that they're jacked up. But again, back to someone like Miles, you don't know what these athletes are going through. Yeah, they may have a trainer, they may have a nutritionist, but do they have someone who can be an objective person and speak on their behalf and give them some challenging thoughts that can help them with their mental toughness. But I think he's a great example of someone who's very mentally tough. He's going to continue to do very well in the NBA, no matter what team he's for. But he was someone who came from a lot of issues and is going to continue to do well going forward.
Fantastic. I think that's a great analogy with talking about him and just again all the things that we all know that have gone on in Flint and the fact that he's been able to, you know, be supportive of the city and be sort of a shining light for the people there to be proud of what he's been able to accomplish, and hopefully he's going to continue to do great things as he moves forward into the NBA. This coming season. So we'll have to all keep an eye on him and see how Miles ends up playing this year. Let's jump into your 12 rules of flow.
Sure.
And first give us a little definition of what you mean by flow, because I know I'm familiar with the term, but not everybody out there may be familiar with what flow exactly means. And then just jump in and hit some of the highlights of those 12 rules.
Sure. I don't know who your future sponsors may be, if it's Geico, and it's not flow from the Geico commercials or anything like that. You know, flow refers to optimal performance, meaning placing yourself in a position that you can achieve the most. I like to describe the visual, and that's like, I believe with the 1996 finals when Michael Jordan was just hitting every shot as he's done so many seasons. But that one time he just puts his hands up, you know, and said, "I don't know how it happened." Or I was with a group of coaches after I saw you guys in Cleveland, and I described it as driving to work and making every green light. And if you can't relate to that, think about driving and getting every red light, spilling your coffee, and getting a flat tire. So you can know what flow is not. So what I like to tell people, and I've experienced myself, that if you are a believer, you can put yourself in a position by subtle and outwardly actions that you can do where you can set yourself up to live in flow. And I think we experience it sometimes, but we do it so unconsciously. But it really has a lot to do with your mindset and some of these 12 things that we can go into. You know, first being goal setting. Goal setting is very important. And maybe all of us on this podcast right now can understand that. But for a younger generation, and Jason, you kind of alluded to with some of your fourth graders and your middle school basketball team, they're very careful not to set goals. And this is based on what I call FOF, a fear of failure. They don't want to set a goal for fear of not reaching it. I was with a football player not just earlier today, and if I gave you his specs, you would just say, "Wow, what a monster of a kid." But you know, he doesn't necessarily want to go hard for fear of not reaching a goal he set for himself. So goals are very important. It's very important to write your goals down and put them in somewhat of a two-dimensional world and not just think about them or just, you know, say them out loud. But when you write them down, that brings you closer. The next is imagery. And I kind of talked about that earlier as far as that USA basketball shield coming up or just being able to imagine something that's really important and special to you. Then we go into the mental rehearsal part. You know, can you actually mentally rehearse an experience? A lot of times we have undue anxiety because we worry about an outcome, but we don't realize that when it comes down to individuals at your job or individuals in your relationships, you know these personalities and their mannerisms so well that you can almost anticipate how they're going to act. So why not mentally rehearse an outcome? And instead of letting it be a 1-2 outcome, think about steps 3, 4, 5, and 6. And I think when we go through that mental rehearsal process, it can really help us in being able to manage our anxiety. Positive self-talk. This is really important. And again, when you talk about the generation that's too cool for school, Mike, they don't want to talk. They don't want to clap it up. They don't want to make any noise. Positive self-talk is very important. You almost have to be your own coach. You have to be your own hype man, and that can really help you with skill acquisition too. You talked about working on that left hand, which is a great example. You know, being able to tell yourself you got to go left and right. I mean, it's these little things you can repeat over and over again that can help you going forward. Maintaining proper motivation. What's out there? What do you really want? I told you guys in Cleveland, you know, I want a G4 jet, and it's not just to be a international man of mystery. What I didn't add, but it was consistent with the message I was given, is that not only did I want to just be able to have a team of 12 that I can travel with, but I also want my wife and daughter to be there. And I want to be able to get home in an instant. And in my haste, I didn't include that part. So I'm glad that even on your podcast, I can add that. But what's your motivation? What huge big thing do you have out there that makes you want to push and keep going? So you got maintaining proper motivation, breathing relaxation techniques. As you can remember, Mike, we all took a couple of breathing exercises, and we talked about going to Vegas. And it's not the Vegas I was talking about early on in the show, Las Vegas. We're talking about the vagus nerve, which runs down and can connect to your abdomen when you take a deep breath. And when you activate this nerve with deep breathing, it releases a relaxation effect. So that's the real origin behind taking a deep breath. So we have that. We have concentration exercises. And again, I can't help but think about this generation of young people that, based on the constant stimuli they get, you know, not just from social media, but from actually the electronic device screens. And that's one thing we downplay, the actual screen itself, whether it's your laptop, whether it's your iPad or whatever device you have, that electronic screen gives you such a stimulation that in many cases you need about 3 hours to come down off of that. So how do we work on our concentration skills? You know, we talked about exercises like counting backwards from 100, and I would always have some highly intelligent clients say, well, 100 is not enough. I say, well, count from 1,000, whatever works, right? Whatever works, add a few more zeros, right? Yeah. Then we talk about confidence, and that's really important. And in many cases, when I meet a new client or someone's advocating on their behalf, I can't tell you how many times the first thing they say is that, hey, we got to work on our confidence. And as you remember, Mike, I shared with you some research-based ideas that, you know, confidence is the one thing, a few things you can actually fake it till you make it, meaning one's body and their presence, you know, standing in a big type size presence, the Superman pose, if you will, can lead people to respond to you in a way that even if you're not confident at the time, you can build that up. And I think that's an interesting thing to look at. We also have forming positive health habits, and I'm really careful not to be judgmental when I say that. We all have things we can work on, but I think if we look at it as, you know what, by me making these said sacrifices, it's going to be a positive, a healthy habit for me, that's a good thing. And getting quality sleep, that kind of speaks to the issues many of us may be having with these electronic devices, that when you have a dark room and that screen lights up in your face, it really can impact that REM sleep, that rapid eye movement sleep. And it also leads to not just sleep deprivation, but also sleep fragmentation, where we're jumping up every few hours to call ourselves being in the know by looking at our social media, or looking at the news, or looking at these alerts. You know, there was a time, and I'm not judging, that I had the ESPN alerts because I couldn't miss what was going on, but I was jacking my sleep up. You know, I mean, you want to be the first one to tell your buddy about the trade and everything, but you know, sometimes get good sleep may be better. So again,
Mike doesn't know anyone like that.
Yeah, Coach Jason. Coach Jason never sends me texts about what trades are happening or what Adrian Wojnarowski is reporting. He never sends me any of those. Never get those, Lindsay. Never get them.
You know, I started out by saying I'm being non-judgmental, and I included myself in there at one point. I'm talking to hoop heads. I know what's going on with that. But, you know, and finally, you know, striving under pressure is what we finished with when we were in Cleveland. And I really like to make an emphasis on language. You know, and it's not don't be a potty mouth, but it's almost kind of like the same. It's really about what you say. How often do we say, oh, if I can just survive, if I can just get by, if I could just, as opposed to saying, you know, I want to strive under pressure. Pressure is my opportunity to perform. I use the example of a championship basketball game, 2 free throws to win a championship. That's an enormous amount of pressure. That's pressure you will remember for your entire life. However, what is on the other side of the pressure, Mike and Jason? What's on the other side? A championship. So I talk to my athletes about reframing pressure. You know, on the other side of the pressure is your purpose. And I think if you look at it like that and you put in the work, whether it's taking the free throws and doing your reps or whatever you're supposed to do to be great at your craft, you can strive under pressure and not necessarily just get by and survive. So those are the 12 rules of flow. I think if we're constantly mindful of those 12 items going forward, that can put us in a position of what we call automaticity, meaning you can just be on automatic. You can be just flowing. You can just be going. You can just be present in the moment and do the things you need to do. So those are the 12 things I emphasize, whether it's in a huge setting like the one we were at together with a number of coaches, or in, you know, bit by bit steps when I'm working with athletes on a smaller scale.
I'm glad that I got to hear that, because obviously Mike had already heard all that. I really appreciate everything you just said, and I'm just curious a little bit about how your youth sports experience kind of helped shape the way that you do your job and the way that you came up with this 12 rules of flow. Like, how did that kind of inspire you to do what you do?
You know, it's a very great question, and I must say I probably have not received that question yet, but it's ironic. I thought back to my childhood just the other day and the colorful coaches that I had, and I probably can quote give more life quotes from my coaches than I could sports quotes. And I had one baseball coach, I won't say his name, he wasn't a great coach at all, but he was a man's man. I mean, some of the things he would say still resonate with me today. But one thing I do remember consistently, that there was a different coaching style then than there is now. And any athletic director in America is going to be the one to tell you, you can't do the things then that need to be done now. So what happens is they're a challenge. And I like to say it's almost like you have to have that adapter for your TV to switch it over. You have to have something that can allow you to evolve and continue to get the same amount of power, but still be functional for today's climate. So the challenge I had with growing up with those fire and brimstone type coaches who can talk about you, talk about your mama, and expect to get the best out of you, for whatever it's worth, for whatever reason, good, bad, or indifferent, our young people do not respond to that. And more importantly, society will not elevate those type of coaches to be in leadership roles. So with that being said, most of us who came up like that, I think we can still have that desire. We can still have that willpower, but we have to be able to articulate it in a way that this generation of athletes can get the best of it. Maybe it comes off not in our words, but by our work ethic. You know, maybe it comes off not in what we can physically do to a young person, but the example that we can set. But the challenge is going to be, Jason, for so many great, great, great coaches, is to be able to make that transition while also not having basically an identity crisis, because they've been known as Coach Brown, Coach Young, Coach Huddleston, and they've been a certain way for so long, but now in steps this athletic director who has to stand in the balance between a coach's program and parents and the media, and, you know, when we get to the collegiate level, potential lawsuits, and no AD in America is going to lose their job to promote a fire and brimstone, you know, type of coach. So the challenge I put to all my coaches out there, young, old, you know, old school, new school, is what new tools can you put in your toolbox that will allow you to still be effective and use all of your great years of experience to be able to reach this generation of athletes? So to answer your question, yeah, I had some tough rootin' tootin' coaches, and you know, we thought that was the norm, and at that point it was the norm. But 2018 to 2020 and beyond, there has to be a different methodology and connecting with these athletes, and those who are not willing to evolve will devolve and find themselves completely on the sidelines.
So what are some of those tools and techniques that coaches today can use to reach the athletes that they're dealing with? Because, again, I had similar experiences to what you just described, Lindsay. I had a variety of different coaches, some that put their arm around me, and others that didn't put their arm around me, to say it quite lightly. So when we talk about the athlete today, obviously the goal as a coach, the same way the goal 25, 30, 40 years ago as today, the goal is still to maximize our athlete's performance. So how do we, as coaches today, maximize the performance of our athletes so we can get the most out of them as a coach today?
Well, Mike, first of all, after meeting you one time, I can tell you needed some tough coaches. I already know what that was about, you know. So I know you had that, and I say that tongue in cheek. But, you know, I can say a number of things, but the most difficult thing I would say they have to do first is self-reflection. They have to self-evaluate. And that's really tough, Mike, because when you talk about coach insert name Brown, Coach Young, Coach Huddleston, whoever it may be, so much of their identity as a human being is wrapped into that title of being a coach. So now when we're talking about this person has to step back and reflect on their coaching style, which is a part of their personality, because they don't stop calling you coach when you leave the field. They call you coach at the grocery store, at the gas station. Heck, some people don't even know your name. All they know is coach. But that's a way to identify. So you have to really be able to self-evaluate and ask yourself, well, what things do I need to work on in order to transition into this new generation and new coaching area? And one suggestion you remember that I gave, maybe some coaches need somewhat of a hiatus. Maybe that head coach can look at becoming an assistant coach for some time to step back and get a different perspective. But the question I also pose is, are individuals' egos ready to take that hit? And before I get into any type of, you know, techniques or anything like that, a person just really has to self-evaluate and ask, you know, am I ready to make this change? You know, is this completely my identity? You know, unlike an athlete, there comes a time when the playing stops. So your athletic career as actually playing can be relatively short. But however, you can coach for a lifetime. My goodness. So first ask yourself, you know, who am I? Is this coach title a complete part of my identity? And then secondly, you know, can I make certain changes? Am I open to making certain changes? But that leads to a level of vulnerability. And it's really difficult. And I can't say that it's easy, but that's where it has to start. Self-evaluation. And then after you're able to self-evaluate, hopefully you can self-regulate on some of the things you need to work on. It may be your language. It may be your physical expectations and how you approach people. It may be your ability to listen to others, but those are the things that are on an individual basis. And after that self-evaluation, you then can begin to self-regulate. But I think it's a tough job to start that process.
That goes back to what we talked about a half hour ago with our athletes being open to getting out of their comfort zone. Coaches need to do the exact same thing. And I talked with Coach White when we were talking to him yesterday on the podcast about the fact that, you know, when I was a younger coach, you know, I had grown up with basketball and played Division I basketball and got out and was coaching a JV high school basketball team. And at that point, I kind of thought, hey, I know everything there is to know, and didn't necessarily go out and educate myself about different ways and different styles and different things that I could do as a coach that would have made me a lot better. And it wasn't until I was much older that I became more self-aware of the things that I was doing. And not that I was doing anything bad, but just in terms of just becoming better. You know, for a long time, I was in the status quo of, hey, things are going well. I'm doing a good job by kids, and I'm teaching the game. And as I've gone on, I've realized that there's just a lot more to being a great coach than just teaching them how to shoot with their left hand or working on a jump shot. There's just a ton more that you can impart in terms of life lessons and having an impact on kids. And again, if you're not ready to accept that message as a coach, you know, your chances of improving, as you said, are very low.
Sure. And just think about your situation, Mike. You're saying this as, relatively speaking, a volunteer coach. You're not, you know, a multimillionaire Hall of Fame coach. You know, who is in the news on a regular basis, you know, all this scrutiny. So, and again, another thing you said, I'm just using your words, Mike, you know, no one can tell you anything. And that was years ago, you as a volunteer coach. No one can really tell you anything. So who can tell that Hall of Fame inducted coach who sent guys to the NBA, to the NFL, who can pull them to the side? In most cases, it has to be a very close friend who's not on or near the payroll, or a spouse and a significant other. But in many cases, those are compromised type relationships. So what normally gets their attention? Failure, a loss, falling beneath your expectations, scandal. All these negatively, you know, attributed aspects almost have to happen, unfortunately, to get that coach's attention, because who in their right mind is going to go against them? Then you can say, well, that's why you got to have good people on your staff. Well, you know, in the case of Jason being there to support you, if he's on your staff, he can walk away to go look at that 4-month-old and that 20-month-old he talked about. But if you are a 6-figure, 7-figure assistant coach, do you go and challenge the head coach who's probably, you know, as bullheaded as he wants to be, because that's what got him or her to that position? No, you don't. Let's be realistic. So what does it take other than some type of national vulnerability to make someone self-reflect. And then I'll say this finally on that note, and then when they actually do, are they going to be open and say I was wrong, or are they going to double and triple down? So it's a really, really tough situation, and I dare not wish any negative outcome on any coach for them to see. But unless you're at a point where you can kind of say, you know what, I kind of been feeling this way a little while, and let me see and how I can kind of get out there. It's going to take some great coaches to get out front to help lead that charge of people being more self-evaluative and self-reflective and using some self-regulation in turn. That's just my thought on that.
Yeah, I certainly think that you see that's the trend. I mean, that's the way things are going. I mean, the fire and brimstone coaches you described before, I think those coaches are finding it. They're not completely gone, but I think they're finding it more and more difficult to continue to do things the way that they may have been doing them 20 or 30 years ago. It's just, I think it's a much more difficult proposition, not just from how they're dealing with the athletes, but also, you know, administrations and parents and media. There's just a lot out there, and I think it's much tougher to get away with it is maybe the wrong word, but just to be able to conduct yourself in that way. There's just too much scrutiny. The one of the, again, you can look at it as a positive or a negative, but, you know, everybody's got their phone and a camera in their pocket all the time. And so you're much more likely to be caught on video today than certainly you were when all three of us were kids. And so, you know, you got to be watching, you got to be aware. And again, you want to do what's right by your athletes. And that's ultimately what we're talking about. You're trying to do right by your athletes and their mind. We're trying to do right by our athletes and teach them the game and teach them life lessons and help them to improve. And you hope that anybody who's in the business of youth basketball or college sports or whatever the case may be, whatever venue they're in, that they're ultimately responsible and wanting to do what's right for the people that are under their charge. And that's really what, to me, what the coaching profession is really all about.
You know, I appreciate that. And I must say that you've helped me with something, you know, because as you notice in my comments, it was almost like, you know, me not really being sure. But just as we met at a coach's clinic to improve ourselves, maybe, you know, this type of discussion can be introduced in the form of improvement as opposed to life change. But let's talk about you improving, because any coach would tell you, oh, I got great because I go to those camps, I go to those every clinic I could, you know, you hear that story. Well, this is a new piece that's being added. This is the new zone defense, this is the new, you know, flex offense. And, you know, just as you say, you're on top of the latest trends, you have to be on top of the new way to communicate with athletes to get them to be effective. So just taking from this conversation, guys, that's really helped me and better crystallizing a message I could share to help individuals with their transition. So I'm going to definitely take from this in hopes to help others with that.
That's awesome. We appreciate that. Let's jump in. I got a couple questions about, I know you're big on philanthropy, and yeah, you've done a lot of charitable work in your life, and you wrote your book, Unlikely Saviors. Could you talk a little bit about that and kind of what you have going philanthropically in your life right now?
Sure, man. I really appreciate that. You know, the book Unlikely Saviors was written in 2011. At the time, I was transitioning from corporate America. And after an experience at a high school state basketball championship and seeing all the swag these high school athletes had, I mean, Mike, they had NBA swag, and you see them, you know how that goes. And I said, wow. Because I was in corporate America and I was responsible for about $3 million in charitable giving throughout, you know, the Midwest, I said, wow, if these young people had access to the resources I have, they can do so much. I always like to give the analogy, if it was me speaking and maybe the, you know, punter off a University of Alabama championship team in the other room, who do people want to go listen to? I would hope it would be me, but there's something intriguing about an athlete who's been a champion. So that's a universal message. So I created a nonprofit several years ago, and we went into Detroit and went into the middle schools, and we used middle school athletes to promote health and wellness to their classmates. Because just as we are influenced by athletes as adults, you know, these young people were influenced by their peers. So we were really doing things twofold, getting them to be charitable, but also seeing, let them see the power that they have, you know, and being able to do the right thing. Unfortunately, from my experience in a lot of schools right now, many of the troublemakers in many cases are the athletes, which is totally opposite of what we experienced when athletes were expected to be the leaders. But now it seems that, you know, everybody's just trying to be the coolest kid. And you would hope that the athletes can be the ones preventing the bullying. But unfortunately, in many cases, the athletes have become the bully. So I really want to talk about to young people how they can use their platform. And lastly, I'll say, what are you going to do when the cheering stops? What are you going to do when the ball stops bouncing, when unfortunately an injury can take you away from the game faster than expected? You still have a great platform based on your experience in sports to be able to help others as well as help yourself in the future.
Yeah, I think imparting those life lessons is something that, again, if I go back to where I started the transition as a coach, I really think that I began to grow when I started looking at how can I have an impact on the kids that come to my camps and the kids that do training with us and the other activities that we do throughout the year. How can we have a greater impact? We started probably more with my wife than with myself, but she had an idea. She works with a group here in Ohio called Ohio Guidestone, and we started out sponsoring one family at Christmas time, buying gifts. And then the second year we expanded it to a few neighbors. And then the next year we were up, we had 22 families that we brought in. Wow. We brought in some sports teams from the local area, so teams would come in and contribute. And then last year we did 44 families. And now they've put it out to us this year that we're gonna try to double it again. So we're going to try to get to, I think the goal is to get to 90 families this year that we're going to bring people in. And so my point is that that's something that when I was 25 years old would not have even remotely been on my radar. But as I've grown and matured and looked at what I'm really trying to do with this basketball platform that I have to speak to what you said a minute ago, I really want to just use that platform to make a bigger impact. And I see you doing the same thing, and I hear that's what you're talking about. And I think being able to connect with like-minded people who are trying to do those same things in different pockets of the country and in different ways is something that just, that means everything to me. And so I can appreciate all the things that you're sharing with us here on the podcast. So thank you.
No, I'm glad. And congratulations on that stellar growth you've had from 22 to 44 to 90, and that's only going to continue to grow. So definitely keep me abreast of what you're doing with that. And if any way I can be of support to you, definitely will. And I'm not just saying that because we're on the podcast, but I think you can understand I really mean that.
Yeah, absolutely, without question. Lindsay, this has been great. What I'd like you to do before we get out of here is just share your contact information with people so they can get a hold of you. And certainly we're going to put everything in the show notes so that people who come on and listen to the podcast can get connected with you. So go ahead.
I appreciate that. Lindsay Huddleston with Sport Psychology Solutions. You can get me on Facebook at that. On Twitter, I'll probably follow up under HSolutions1 or SPS Flow. My direct contact is area code 313-414-7378. Again, 313-414-7378. And finally, my website is www.sportpsychsolutions.org, or you can email me at lh@sportpsychsolutions.org. lh@sportpsychsolutions.org. But I appreciate you guys having me on. I know you're going to continue to do great things, so I'll keep an eye out on you, and definitely can be a resource for you in the future.
Absolutely. We're very excited about the conversation that we just had. I think it has tremendous value for our audience and to all of our people out there that are listening. I would highly recommend if you have a need for any of the things that Lindsay was talking about today that you reach out to him. Again, he and I met very, very briefly after his speech at the Cleveland Basketball Academy, USA Basketball Coaches Academy, and he was gracious enough in that short 5-minute conversation to jump on with us, and I'm sure you can tell from the conversation that he's providing tremendous value to the kids and athletes that he comes into contact with. So, Lindsay, thanks again for jumping on with us. We truly appreciate it. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on our next episode.
Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player, our academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have 4 different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, brought to you by Head Start Basketball.